Hello, everyone. Welcome to the second episode of Your Brain in the Time of COVID-19, where we explore the neuroscience behind the emotions we're experiencing in this pandemic. This is Emily.
I'm Gaia. Hi, everyone.
So, Gaia, before I start, I have to ask you a question. Who are you?
What? Emily? Who am I? You've known me for like, what, 5 years?
Yeah, I have. But I'm just asking on behalf of the listeners. Because last time after we released our first episode, one big unanimous feedback we got was, hey, why didn't you say anything about who you are? I was like, oh, true, good point. Thank you. So tell us, who are you, Gaia?
Okay, well, yes, fair enough. Hello to all our listeners. I'm Gaia. I'm a PhD student at Duke NUS. What do? So I study senescence in neurons, and I spend a lot of time thinking about what pushes the neurons into such a state. I guess I love running and playing sport. I'm also very interested in how exercise confers protection against so many diseases, you know. I guess that's it about me. Emily, it's your turn. Tell us about yourself.
Hi, so I'm Emily. I'm Gaia's friend from college. And we used to work in neighboring labs as undergrads for a year. And our lab space at ANU was actually open plan, so we actually got to really poke our heads around in each other's business a lot.
Yeah. And then we used to, do you remember, go for walks together to get cookies and we were like super angry at our experiments?
I know, true. Those cookies from Union Court Subway.
Yep.
So I'm now a PhD student at Johns Hopkins University studying tiny little fruit flies who have trouble falling asleep, which is a huge irony because I'm like the exact opposite. I'm too good at falling asleep sometimes. So that's us. And today we're looking at what happens in our brain when we're all self-isolating at home, not being able to see our friends in person every day. Mm-hmm. With that, let's jump right into it. This is Your Brain in the Time of COVID-19, the lonely, self-isolating brain. I want to start by talking a little bit about why we decided to do this episode on loneliness. It's definitely one of the first to come to mind when we talk about emotions in this pandemic. So, Gaia, can I ask you what makes loneliness so interesting and relevant to you?
Loneliness is really interesting, right? Because I think it really is the paradox of modern existence. Because we've seen in the 21st century this exponential increase in our access to social media opportunities, right? But that's really come hand in hand with this increased isolation from society. And I think what's happened is that with COVID-19, that isolation and loneliness has become much worse than before. And it's really been brought to the forefront of our conscious perception of our lives. For example, when I was living by myself, a lot of the social interactions I would derive joy and happiness from would be, you know, going to the gym or some open mic night events and things like that. I'd see the same people there over and over again. And these events were transitory, but we'd all have a good laugh and a joke. And then I'd come away from those events feeling like I belong to this group, you know, I have friends here. But then with this lockdown, those avenues are closed, which leaves me with fewer interactions on a day-to-day basis.
That is so true. I was definitely feeling it, especially when the lockdown first started. You know, as an introvert, I initially didn't think it really impacted me that much. But I've really started to really miss the face-to-face interactions.
Yeah.
I feel like there is this threshold to reach out to someone and to tell them something now that we are physically apart. But when we are physically together, I can just turn my head around and bother the person next to me. And I really, really miss that.
Totally. Like, even just laughing together at something really stupid.
Yeah, right. And after we went to lockdown, I still make an effort to reach out to people and set up Zoom sessions, etc. But because I was relying so much on those few interactions I do have to fulfill my socializing need, I found myself often having an unrealistic expectation for those interactions that I do have. Like, you should be having fun every second of this Zoom call. Why aren't you having fun?
Oh,
which,
man,
unfortunately kind of took the joy away from them.
Oh, totally. And you know, I feel like being home like alone for such a long time also takes away the muscle memory we have for how to be in a social situation. You know, I really hope that by doing this episode, we can explore a little bit into why we feel lonely and what's going on in our brain, but also why not all social situations are created equal.
And we are saving a really adorable scientific paper studying our relation with kittens at the very end. My personal favorite.
Emily, some people are scrolling to the end right now, I'll bet you.
No, we've loved them right from the start. Don't go yet.
So one of the world's biggest surveys on loneliness was actually completed by the BBC in 2018. And they had like a staggering 55,000 people respond and complete that survey.
That's so cool. What did they find?
Well, a couple of really interesting things, actually. So firstly, the type of culture you live in has big implications on whether you feel lonely or not. So for example, people from cultures that highly value independence, like Western cultures, people are less likely to speak up when they feel lonely. And furthermore, they actually derive support and comfort from their relationship with their partners. On the other hand, in cultures with extended families and joint families, the people who are at risk of feeling lonely are actually older women.
Oh, that is very interesting. Intuitively, it feels like joint families will see a lot less loneliness because they are the support structure within living with people, right?
Right. And I think the more I read into it, the more I realized loneliness is actually quite complicated. And I think we should start maybe by exploring a little bit about why we feel lonely in the first place. Why go through the motions of having, like, you know, that aching sense of emptiness and void?
Are you talking about what might be the evolutionary basis for loneliness as a survival instinct?
Yeah, exactly. And if you think about it, you know, stress, which we talked about in our last episode, right? It's a very basic survival instinct. We've developed it to survive. But what role might loneliness play in survival? And the thing is, when I was researching this topic, what was really interesting was that, you know, loneliness as a literary theme gets mentioned as early as the oldest surviving poem in Western literary history, which is the Epic of Gilgamesh, which was written around 1800 BC. So it's actually always sort of existed.
I see. So you're saying it's not really a product of our modern world with our nuclear family and stuff.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm not really surprised. Like, we thrive on creating relationships, don't we? So I was wondering, what does evolutionary biology say about it?
Well, actually, interestingly enough, the current thinking is that actually it does really support survival.
So it's the same way like stress we talked about?
Yeah. The thing is, the biology of loneliness, right, is a lot more subtle than stress, but it's no less destructive to our overall health and well-being when it becomes chronic. For example, research has demonstrated that loneliness can result in poorer mental health and even increased morbidity and mortality.
So, like, why even evolve loneliness? What positive role might it play in our survival?
So, early in our species history, we were always forced to band together, right? As couples, as families, in tribes. And that provided mutual protection and assistance. Well, scientists think that loneliness, or rather the pain that it causes, actually pushes us and drives us to renew connections, therefore ensuring that we have, you know, a better chance of survival.
I see. It is like an internal negative stimulus that drives change in behavior.
Exactly. So like hunger or thirst, it results in us changing our behavior, and that increases our chances of survival. In fact, you know, the very recent, there was some research released from MIT. It hasn't been peer reviewed yet, but seems to indicate that, you know, loneliness triggers cravings that are very similar to hunger.
Huh, that's so interesting. So maybe like loneliness is also helping us better our survival.
Yeah, exactly. So Dr. John Cacioppo, who was a leading expert in loneliness, actually posited in his evolutionary theory that, you know, the beneficial and reliable social interactions increase the chances of survival and reproduction, right? And social groups offer safety, security. They allow us to expend less energy. And so the rewards that we get from these interactions are deeply wired in our psyche. So at the level of our biology, what's happening is that loneliness acts as an aversive stimulus that motivates us to change our behavior towards one that increases our survival. It's almost like a warning to alert us to the threat to our social needs and existence. It increases the motivation to attend to that loss of stimulus that occurs when we move away from a social.
So what you're saying is that the biology of our body is wired to push us towards becoming more social and seeking protection of others in our species.
Yeah, exactly.
But what is happening in our body when we feel lonely?
Why, Emily? I think it's time to talk about the history and physiology of loneliness.
Did you fall down a rabbit hole again looking at this one too?
Oh, you better believe it, dude. The history of science is like my pet pastime, I kid you not. So like stress, which you talked about in our last podcast, right? Loneliness has existed for a long time, but only was given the negative connotation and started to be used to describe the feelings of isolation in the 18th and 19th century.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we only started recognizing the need to study loneliness more rigorously because of Dr. Frieda von Reichmann, who, by the way, was a brilliant psychiatrist who escaped from Nazi persecution to the US and then revolutionized the field of psychotherapy. Actually, I want to talk a little bit about her. Back in her time, a lot of patients were suffering psychosis and they were just simply locked up in mental institutions and then were borderline abused. But she was really adamant about treating every patient with empathy and respect, and she had anything to make the patient feel better attitude. She held the radical belief that, you know, there isn't a binary switch between being sane and insane, but really a spectrum that one slides along.
I feel like that spectrum idea is really a progressive idea that we are still grappling even today.
Yeah, she really was amazing and one of my personal scientific heroes. And she believed that one of the factors that can slide you on that spectrum towards insanity, or in today's words, you know, worse mental health outcomes, is loneliness.
Oh no, being alone makes us crazy.
Well, loneliness is not defined as being alone. Loneliness is the perceived social isolation. So take note of the key word here, which is perceived, right? It appears that loneliness is really in the experience of the person feeling it. It isn't objective solitude. So to quote Paul Tillich, the wise philosopher, solitude expresses the glory of being alone, while loneliness expresses the pain of feeling alone. If you think about it,
that is so accurate. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So people can have full social calendars and a lot of friends, but can still be lonely. And on the other hand, there are people with just one or two close friends who seem absolutely fulfilled.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why scientists, when they need to study loneliness, they use surveys to study it in the population, because it needs to be self-reported.
So when we perceive that we are lonely, what is happening in our brain?
Yeah, okay. So remember when we talked about all the rewards that come being part of a social group that would have provided a lot of security early in our human evolution?
Like safety and shelter?
Yeah, and greater survival of offspring, etc. The positives of such outcomes are really wired deep in the reward centers in our brain.
And the reward centers send out signals called dopamine that feels so good to us and motivates us to behave in a certain way in order to feel that signal again and again.
Exactly. It's sort of the way for the brain to tell you to do something that is good for you. My favorite example that I always talk about is a bar of chocolate, right? A bar of chocolate contains sugar, right? And biologically, we have always used sugar as a source of energy. So when you eat that bar of chocolate, your brain gets told that there's sugar in it, puff. There's like a release of dopamine and you feel really good. And then you're motivated to do it again.
And that is how I got addicted to chocolate.
Bingo. So that dopamine pathway, interestingly, is also involved in loneliness too. Emily, can you take a guess at which areas of the brain might be involved in motivating you to seek social interactions?
Let me think. So it must be an area that's part of the dopamine reward system that motivates you to go seek interactions. So would it be the VTA?
Yeah, the ventral tegmental area, or VTA. It's an area that's buried deep inside your brain, and it's part of the dopamine system. And scientists have shown that actually when social interactions take place, the neurons in these areas are getting activated. Even cooler, when scientists then activate these neurons artificially in mice, it increases social interaction between mice.
That's really fascinating. So would you say that the lonely feeling we experience is simply a lack of the feel-good dopamine and the activation of that VTA area?
Well, that's a good question. And I think that loneliness, it probably needs multiple areas of the brain to be felt. I mean, if you actually think about it, it's very rare that a psychological concept like loneliness or happiness can find one single neural correlate in the brain.
That's true. As curious humans, we always ask, what in the brain makes us feel lonely or happy or angry?
Yeah.
But it is almost always more complicated than that, because individual brain cells or brain regions don't know those English words.
Yeah.
And the way our brain do things is not confined by these English words we invented to describe our subjective feelings.
Absolutely. And the thing is, there are so many things that get summed up in the word loneliness, right? I mean, one part of loneliness is the motivation that you need to feel to socialize. But I mean, to feel lonely, you probably also need to recall memories of the times when you didn't feel lonely. So the hippocampus, where memory is stored, comes into play. And then loneliness is so stressful, especially in a scary situation like the pandemic.
That's true. So the entire system that we talked about in the last episode, the HPA axis and the amygdala and cortisol, also comes into place. So could that be why long-term loneliness can have really negative consequences on our bodies? Like, I've read studies where scientists follow people over several decades and found that loneliness correlates with higher morbidity and mortality. And young adults who reported having greater instances of loneliness also has increased cardiovascular health risk. Their hearts are less healthy.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, scientists have seen that actually people who report feeling lonely have physical changes that happen in their brains and their bodies. Like the HPA and the immune system are often dysregulated when people experience chronic loneliness.
That's really not great news in this pandemic. So I guess if you, the listener, are feeling lonely and need someone to talk to, please just feel free to send us an email or something, and we can be your neuroscience friends.
Please do. And I know that isn't necessarily the easiest thing to do, because here is the paradox about being chronically lonely, right? It becomes a self-fulfilling thing where the more lonely we get, the more we start isolating ourselves from others.
Oh no, I mean, thank you for bringing that up, because I feel we probably will be seeing it a lot the longer we need to self-isolate during this pandemic. Like, to be honest, I personally felt it sometime.
Yeah, well, Dr. Cacioppo, who I mentioned at the start, right, in the evolution section, he describes in his loneliness model that social isolation is actually equivalent to feeling unsafe. And this puts people in a state of hypervigilance against threats. So when we're feeling lonely, we perceive the social world to be a lot more threatening. And then we start expecting more negative social experience. And then we fixate and remember such instances a lot more.
I think that is such an accurate description for when I felt lonely. And even the few interactions I do have with friends, I don't enjoy them as much as when I'm happy. So if we start isolating for a long period of time, I guess it's harder for us to regulate our own thoughts. A bit like anxiety, isn't it? The threat isn't really present, but our brain are on the lookout for threats, which might not actually be there.
Absolutely. And we stop perceiving positive social interactions as rewarding. In fact, our reward center, the VTA, stops releasing as much feel-good dopamine molecules. And then we become less motivated to reach out to people.
That is more the reason for you, our listener, to reach out. If you have a friend who you haven't heard from for a bit, it's really not an easy time to maintain social connections. So we may just all have to try and go a little bit further than what we're used to.
It never hurts. Take a moment to check in on all your friends.
So Gaia, I wanted to tell you something that's really scary that happened to me.
Oh no, what?
So in iPhones, there's this really scary function called screen time, where you can check how many hours you spend on your phone every day, and more specifically on which apps.
Oh no.
So I checked, and I've been spending 4.5 hours on social media every day. 4.5 hours. When I saw this number, I was like, holy cow, do I have a social media addiction or something? Is this supposed to be really bad for me?
Oh man, I get it. I totally get it. We grow up hearing a lot about how social media is bad for our well-being, right? Especially how it makes us more lonely. But I mean, how have you been feeling about your time on social media? I remember you saying you did try to delete Twitter.
Yeah, I did. But right now, I'm still spending a lot of time on video chats and group chats with my friends, because that's like my only way of reaching them. Mm. And I do genuinely love just being able to hear how their days are going and talk about TV shows that we are watching or what restaurant delivers we've been trying.
I mean, yeah, nowadays we do have so very limited options when it comes to how we interact with people socially, right? And getting in touch with friends over chats might be the closest thing you can do in this situation.
Right. But even before COVID, I was using social media a lot. I think it's actually not too uncommon for our generation to actually move out of our hometowns when we grow up for jobs or for education.
Yeah.
So in my case, I moved from Beijing to Melbourne for high school, then to Canberra for uni, then to US for a PhD. I really do already rely on social media to see what my friends on the other side of the world are up to. Also, it is a way to not be totally cut off from where I used to call home, even when I'm physically away. Although sometimes I can feel that I'm spending a little too long on social media, and it doesn't always affect me positively.
Right. Yeah. I know, because there are a lot of studies, right, that show that people from our generation are feeling more lonely and isolated from society. I'm not sure how much of it is due to the rise of social media and how much of it is because we're spending so much time on our devices and not, you know, looking up and interacting with people.
That's also what I was wondering when I was researching for this episode. Is social media really that bad for us? Like you mentioned, we've seen a lot of super scary headlines about the detrimental effects of social media on our health. Those effects, no doubt, can be true in some cases.
Yeah.
But it seems that from my research that the answer is actually not a simple yes or no. In fact, what purpose we're using social media for and how we are using it really, really matter.
Wait, what do you mean?
So, for example, you can be using social media in a passive way, like just scrolling, or in an interactive way, like tagging your friends under a really funny post, or meeting new friends based on a common interest. Social media can be more beneficial if we use it to engage more with people we want to connect with in a meaningful way, rather than just passively consuming it.
I see.
I actually really, really hated how Facebook pushes a lot of random articles to me now that have nothing to do with what my friends are up to.
Yeah, and then you just end up passively scrolling through them. And you don't want that, right? Especially because a lot of the content that appears on social media feeds are designed to catch attention and arouse emotions. And that may not be the most healthy content to consume. What are some of the other factors that matter when you were doing your research? What did you find?
So psychologists have found that a key factor in determining whether social media is good or bad for you is your tendency to compare your accomplishments, situations, and experiences with others.
Oh man, that totally makes sense. We really shouldn't compare ourselves with others. That's such a sure way to take the joy out of anything.
Yeah, right. Although it's quite natural for us to compare ourselves to others to a certain extent, when we don't have an objective way to assess our own ability or opinions, for example, when you graduate from college and there is no longer a grade or a test score that gives you information about how you did, social comparison becomes a quick and dirty way for our brains to assess where we are at. And sometimes we can do it to self-improve or to get some kind of assurance that we aren't doing that badly. We all do it to some extent, but how much we compare with others differ from person to person.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can totally see why comparing yourself with people on social media can make you feel really sad and inadequate, right? Because everyone seems to live such a perfect life on social media.
Yeah, I feel like on some platforms, there's increasing pressure to put your best foot forward, to promote like an elevated version of yourself rather than the real version, because likes and affirmations are very, very rewarding for us.
True. And I know psychologists have actually made the distinction, right, between social loneliness, which is like the lack of contact with others, versus emotional loneliness, which does not really depend on how many people you know or how many connections you have, but has everything to do with whether you feel you can get a sense of support, affirmation, and belonging with those people and those connections.
That's actually such an accurate explanation of how social media can make you feel more lonely. If the thousands of friends or followers don't allow us to feel vulnerable in front of them, then we are still emotionally lonely. I know academic Twitter can be the actual social comparison hell sometimes. Many were made to believe increasingly that they don't belong. So recently, there's actually a huge push on the academic Twitter to share your failure story. How many of your applications are rejected rather than accepted? And how you're actually not able to be productive during a pandemic.
That feels more like a community. So from what you told me, social media seems to have a different effect on everyone, right? So why is it getting such a bad rep?
So in order to figure out the relationship between social media and loneliness, scientists have done two types of study. The first type is a survey, so asking people how much time they spend on social media each day and how lonely they feel. And they did find that people who use more than 2 hours of social media every day are on average more lonely than people who only spend less than half an hour on social media. So I wanted to ask you, Gaia, what do you think that means?
It means heavy social media use is correlated with loneliness. However, it does not tell us if social media use causes loneliness, although it's definitely consistent with the hypothesis that social media causes loneliness. There is another interpretation, though. Maybe people who feel lonely use more social media to try and alleviate their loneliness.
And there's also a third interpretation that feeling lonely and using more social media are both just results or symptoms of another underlying cause. So correlation does not equal to causation.
Oh, yep. Definitely something to keep in mind when you read scientific studies. What about that second type of study? Were they able to find causation in that?
The second type is actually going into people's lives and artificially manipulating their social media use. So psychologists at UPenn ask students to reduce their daily use of Facebook, Instagram, and Snapchat to just 10 minutes per day for 3 weeks. And the psychologists assessed how anxious, depressed, or lonely these students are feeling before and after the study. And the students who have been limiting their social media use reported to be way less depressed or lonely.
Yeah, okay. I feel much more convinced now because it feels like those results actually followed an experimental manipulation and the causal link between social media use and increased loneliness is much more likely.
I agree. However, I wonder if this conclusion can be generalized to our self-isolating time during COVID. So one thing is that these students have a lot going on in their life otherwise, and social media may have been distracting them from interacting with real people in their life. But the situation is a bit different now with the lockdown.
I do know that social media use has been shown to really help like elderly people who live alone to feel more connected and less lonely. And I feel like, you know, that study could apply more to some of us at this moment right now during lockdown and self-isolation.
Yeah, I can totally relate. And positive interactions on social media can trigger the same social reward pathway in our brain, just like real life interactions.
Yeah. So I guess during the pandemic, we can use social media to interact with our friends and family in meaningful ways. But I think the key is that we should be super careful not to compare our real lives to anyone's social media life.
That's right. And you can get a feel for what is the amount of social media exposure that actually makes you happy and comfortable. And if you feel that it is getting a little bit out of hand, most smartphones actually have built-in functions or apps to limit social media use as well. So one thing you can't actually get from social media is contact comfort.
Yeah, speaking of which, I heard that pet adoption has skyrocketed since the pandemic started.
I do envy my friends who have a furry friend at home with them. And it always brightens my day seeing them during Zoom calls.
Totally. Public service announcement. Please never apologize for getting Zoom bombed by your cat.
Never apologize, and please do it again.
And again and again.
Yeah. I feel like it has been really deeply ingrained in our consciousness that having an animal friend makes us happier. It is definitely a very unique topic to read on, because humans have been having animal companions for thousands of years before we sought to make it a scientific research topic to assess what effect it actually has
True.
On us.
I feel like the scientists are still scratching their heads, you know, while people are already bringing emotional support animals onto airplanes.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like this field of science has really been constantly inspired by and following the footsteps of our real life practices. So I remember before I started my PhD, I actually once worked closely with an NGO called Integral Service Dog Australia that Ooh. Used service dogs to help veterans and first responders with PTSD. So they developed this really cool 6 to 12 month program where the veterans go to classes and train a Labrador to become their own service dog. And we were trying to develop a pitch to help them get sponsorship. And I was so excited because when do you ever get to leverage your neuroscience background in consulting?
Yeah.
And so I went and looked for scientific evidence, and I actually couldn't find any super comprehensive studies with all the proper like double blind and all the controls. But I did find that in the US, there are already similar programs that helped a lot of veterans already.
That's wonderful. I guess medicine and basic science definitely inspire each other constantly. What do we know, Emily, about human-animal interactions?
People have studied how having a pet correlates with exercising more and having a healthier body, how having bonded with pet as a kid helps with cognitive development, and how animals can be used outside of homes, in schools, nursing homes, or even prisons as therapies. While there does seem to be a positive effect overall, it hasn't been easy to pinpoint the brain mechanism through which animals help us.
That's really, really fascinating. I guess there can't be a simple answer, right? A lot of people love their companion animals as a friend or even a family member. So
Right.
imagine there must be so many ways having that connection can help.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of family members, there's a really, really interesting study that came out last year about how cats form specific styles of attachment to their human friends, just like infants do.
Really? I know that dogs can be super attached to their humans, and babies definitely are attached to their parents, but cats? Aren't they kind of like always plotting against you?
Not all cats. So, attachment style is a concept in child development research that describes the nature of relationship between a child and their caregiver. This idea is found out by a development psychologist named Mary Ainsworth. And I just realized during my research that she briefly worked at Johns Hopkins from 1955 to 1974. But unfortunately, during her time there, Hopkins was really, really backwards and didn't even let her eat in the same room as her male colleagues
Oh, no.
or recognize her for the important work she did.
Wow.
It's really horrible. And I didn't even know she worked here, let alone being celebrated like any of the giants who worked at Hopkins before, who are males.
Oh, man.
So sorry to digress, but it really brought me on a little history journey researching this part. I promise I'll get back to the cats ASAP.
No, of course. It's such an important theory, right? That's still discussed a lot today. The attachment styles we developed as a baby is theorized to have a really profound effect later in life on how we form relationships with other people.
Definitely. So, in order to assess the attachment style of the baby and the caregiver would spend 2 minutes in a totally foreign room with the baby. And then he or she would leave for 2 minutes and then would return for another 2 minutes.
I'm guessing the babies will be really stressed out to be left in the room alone.
Exactly. So babies with secure attachment become less stressed when the caregiver returns. But baby with insecure attachment behave a little bit differently.
Oh.
Some are stressed when the caregiver left, but remains angry or passive when they return.
Ah.
It is termed ambivalent attachment. And some other babies are indifferent to the caregiver leaving
wow.
and returning. And that is termed avoidant attachment.
That's really interesting. Let me guess, are all cats avoidant?
You'd be surprised. More than 60% of the cats tested have secure attachment with their humans.
Wow.
It seems that when you leave, they're sad, but when you return, they become happy and come and find you. About 10% of them are avoidant, like you said. They don't care about your presence that much. And about 30% are ambivalent. They're sad when you leave, but remain pissed at you
Aww,
for leaving, even when you return.
I didn't know that.
They're like little babies. And the experimenter followed these cats from childhood to adulthood, and these attachment styles remain stable wow. throughout their lifespan.
Oh my gosh. Please give your animal friends consistent love, guys. Actually, it makes me think that after COVID, some animals are going to have a really hard time when their humans return to work.
I know. I feel like it is so important that if you're thinking of adopting during the pandemic, to really also think about how it will be after the pandemic. Like, can you still spend enough time outside of work with your animals so they're not lonely? And can you still afford to care for them in this strange, turbulent state the world is in?
Oh, definitely. It should be a very, very thoughtful decision.
Yeah, definitely. And with that, I think we have come to the end of what we plan to discuss today. Thank you for listening. And especially thank you to the friends and strangers who helped us share this episode and said really kind words to us. It means so much to see people from so many countries listening.
Yeah, even a lot of countries on the other side of the world that we've never been to. It was wonderful. Mm. If you like this podcast and want to support us, please give us a good review on the podcast platform you use. That'll really, really help other people to see it.
And of course, share with all your family and friends. So please join us next time as we explore the neuroscience of grief in the episode, The Grieving Brain. We hope that you stay safe, take care of yourself and each other.